Bandwidth for this podcast is provided by CacheFly at cachefly.com. This is the iPhone Ellie Podcast, episode 52 for August 25th, 2009. Vinny don't get no respect. All right, it's time for the iPhone LA Podcast. I'm Michael Johnston, and this is the show where we discuss all things iPhone, iPod Touch, iTunes, App Store, all that fun stuff. Tonight, we have a usual cast of, you know...
Of ruffians.
Ne'er-do-wells.
Yes. There they are. Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, and as always, it's great to be here. And hey, how about that iPhone?
How about that? I wonder if that's going to catch on.
It might. I don't know.
And from the MacCast, Mr. Adam Christensen. Hey, Adam.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm still thinking about buying one of those iPhone-y thingies kids are talking about.
I'm just thinking I'm using up all my energy for this, like the first 30 seconds of the show, and then I'll just pass out, and you guys can carry it.
Don't do that. I'm sleep deprived as well.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's jump into it. Let's see, what are we talking about first? Apple investigating cases of exploding iPhones in the EU. Okay. You heard about this?
How come they're only in the EU?
Clearly those Europeans don't know how to use their iPhone.
Maybe they use them in the shower.
I use mine in the shower. You know, for Twitter and stuff. But
oh, right,
so,
right, of course.
So,
no, I think it's just the recent reports, right, have been coming out of there. Don't iPhones and cell phones in general and laptops and all these things explode like everywhere?
Yeah, I think it's a regular thing.
It's a value added feature.
Serious? Well, if you're a secret agent.
No. I mean, we're joking. I mean, not like, oh, they're exploding every 5 minutes. No, but I mean, it happens. This is not a problem of devices. This is a problem of lithium ion battery technology.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, essentially, there are iPhones exploding, which I doubt it's a violent explosion. I've heard stories. I think it was with an iPod or an iPhone that caught someone's like living room on fire. Are you guys remembering this at all?
I thought that was like a Dell laptop or something, or a Sony laptop.
Okay, you're right. I think it was something that had something to do with a computer that had a problem. But yeah, so it's a lithium ion battery problem. And this is the first I've heard of any iPhone explosions or spontaneous combustions, period.
There was a report, and I forget where the numbers came from, but you know, there was a Consumer Product Safety Division report. It was this story recently where, one of the news agencies had gotten a hold finally of this 800-page document that Apple had on reports, because anytime you hear about one of these incidences like Apple, they're required to report it in the U.S. to the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and I guess they have these 800 pages of documents, and some agency filed a... And didn't we talk about this on the show? They filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act to get this information, and they finally got it. And they poured through the poor report, and there were like 17 incidences of iPods. I think they were looking specifically at iPods, not iPhones, but 17 incidences of iPods in the U.S. over 4 or 5 years.
And how many iPods does Apple sell a year?
Yeah, exactly.
Like at least 100.
Right.
So the Consumer Product Safety Commission, they're aware this happens. This does happen, but it's such a, you know, it's like getting struck by lightning. And I don't want to diminish if it happened to you, if you're going to freak out. If you're one of those 17 people, you're absolutely going to freak out. And it's scary and it's dangerous and it can start fires and all these other things. But, you know, we have to kind of step back to reality and go, you know, this isn't just happening in iPods. It isn't just happening. You know, it's a lithium ion battery problem. And every once in a while, a defective one gets out there. But with any product, your coffee pot could, you know, start a fire, you know, catch fire suddenly.
Wasn't there a big Samsung battery scare? like last year?
Every manufacturer that uses lithium ion batteries, I think, has had problems with lithium ion batteries at some point.
Yeah, there was a big problem with Sony batteries for a while.
And they found, had them in their laptops,
Yeah, and you know, of course, Apple got hammered in the media for having laptops that explode. But it was everyone.
Yeah. So now, who, like, if you have an iPod, an iPhone that explodes or, you know, causes damage to your house, who do you think, you know, you're only going to be able to speculate on this, but who's, like, responsible for that kind of damage? Does Apple compensate you for that, or is it the battery maker, or is there...
Probably not without a lawsuit. I mean, you'd have a lot of things to prove. I mean, you'd have to prove, you know, how that device was treated. And this is the other thing is, in so many of these cases, so we have 17 cases where this happened, you have no idea what the history of that device was.
Right.
Was it simply just, you know, pristinely taken care of and never dropped and never run through a wash cycle, never been out in moisture, never left in a hot car, never, I mean, there's so many mitigating factors that could have led to the failure of the battery or of the device, and you'll never know. So, and I think that's sort of how the safety commission feels. It's like, if we're not having, you know, if there's 10 million, 20 million iPhones out there in the world, and we know of this happening 17 times, the logic would dictate that there's some mitigating factor. This isn't just a huge batch of defective devices that left the factory.
Mm-hmm. Right. And another thing, just to put this all in perspective, there are actually, apparently, with 17 of these, of the iPods exploding in some way over a 1 year period, Apple has more iPods blow up every year than Microsoft sells Zunes.
Good one.
And again, I don't have these numbers. I want to be clear about these numbers. I don't have them in front of me. I'm doing this from memory. So if I've gotten these numbers wrong, but the point is made that it was a small, very small percentage compared to the number of devices that are out in the market. And I guess we've had two of these in the EU, which is why it's kind of in the forefront of the news right now. Mm. Two different incidences, one in the UK. And where was the other one most recently? I don't remember.
Was it France?
Yeah, might have been.
And just to toss this out there, I do know somebody that has a Zune, so they are out there.
You know, I have to be honest. I'm hearing good things and good reports about the new Zune HD.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, I would actually really like to get my hands on a Zune HD and put it through its paces, and not put it through its paces in the, you know, in the kind of tongue in cheek way.
Yeah, where you're saying,
oh, look at this piece of crap, and let me show you why. But I'd really like to take a look at one and play with it side by side with my iPhone or iPod Touch and just do a nice little detailed analysis on how it performs.
At the risk of sounding like a complete ignorant idiot, do those work on Macs?
No.
No, and that's the problem. And it's not a Mac problem per se. And that's what I'm hearing great things about the hardware. I'm hearing great things about the software interface on the Zune HD, but where it's going to fall apart, and I have used, you know, Microsoft's, you know, Zune Marketplace Media Manager thing.
Yeah.
That is horrible.
I've heard things that are bad. But yeah, so let's bring it back.
They don't have iTunes. They don't have, it's the integration of all that stuff.
There was a screenshot of iTunes, what is it? Nine? iTunes? 8 or 9? What are we at right now?
9 is the next version.
Yeah,
nine. There was a screenshot of iTunes 9 that was allegedly working on a smartphone or something. Do you guys remember this?
I'm calling fakeity fake.
Oh yeah, yeah. Arnold Kim also called fakeity fake on that too. But it was, I guess, interesting. I don't think Apple would ever allow that. I mean, they're irritated with Palm for doing the pre thing. Yeah. Oh. Rubenstein's got to be getting some bad phone calls from Jobs.
I want to know what happened.
Why the falling out, you mean? Or
yeah, like I mean, Steve cannot be happy about that whole situation at all.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's happening a lot for some reason, but not so much. You know, obviously Rubenstein is, you know, actually contributed to, you know, majority of the iPod stuff. But then if you look at, you know, like John Mayer, you know, he played the iPod or the iPhone introduction, and then, you know, 4 months later endorsed, you know, BlackBerry. and what was it? U2.
Bono, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you seen the U2 commercial?
That looks exactly like the Coldplay ad.
And it's... Did they come up with that song themselves?
I think because they stole it from Coldplay, too.
Love him, retire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, now, kind of on this Pre thing, have either of you actually played with the Pre for any length of time?
I've played with the Pre. I have a couple people I know who have the Pre.
Okay, I finally got a chance to really dive into one the other day. And the whole time I was playing with it, I kept thinking, wow, what a beautiful screen. How did Rubinstein let this thing go out the door? I mean, the screen was beautiful. I loved how the icons looked. And then I started to try to figure out how to actually use the thing and navigate. And that whole grid thing with the multiple pages up and down and left and right to try and figure out where your applications were.
Yeah.
And then trying to figure out how to quit an application. And
well, once you figure out how to quit, to be honest, once you figure out how to quit it, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, you have to ask someone, how do you quit an application so that you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but the first 5 minutes for, you know, most people on an iPhone are kind of similar to that, right?
True. But it's just, it felt to me overall like the whole interface was thought partway through.
Yeah.
Because there's so many places as I was going along where I thought, well, this seems overly complex. And I was just really surprised because I assumed with Rubinstein at the helm that the device would feel a lot sleeker than it does.
Well, okay. So my brother had to get for graduating, he had a, you know, his gift from my dad was, let's you know, you're due for an upgrade in the phone. He pays for his phone bill, and you know, go to the Sprint store, pick out whatever phone you want. And I told him, you better get that Pre, you know, he something interesting. And he comes out of there with, you know, some whatever suck phone from Samsung. But the reason he didn't want...
I knew you were going to say Samsung.
Well, he didn't like the Pre because of the keyboard.
Yeah, I had issues with the keyboard also.
Yeah. I mean, it's really small.
And I've talked to several people that own Pres that say that after spending just 5 minutes with an iPhone or an iPod Touch, they prefer the virtual keyboard to the keyboard that's actually on the Pre.
That is an interesting thing. Yeah, but as far as the Pre goes, I have a friend, like I said, who has one, and I sent him. It has an integrated IM client, which is nice, and you can switch between, you know, the, you know, SMSing people or IMing within the same like a messages sort of app. But you know, and it does that cool like associating the person with the account sort of thing, kind of magically. But if it doesn't,
yeah, that's cool.
If it can't figure that out. It's interesting how you actually tell it, because you know, I IM'd the friend and he said, oh, it doesn't show, you know, your name. I don't know how to hook it up that way, so I'm just going to leave it. So there are aspects to it that are weird.
Yeah,
that have that feeling of the, you know, kind of half thought out. But you know, to be honest, the Pre is cool. I like it. It's a nice. It's good on the Sprint network.
Are we going down the phone bashing path?
No, I want to get out of that.
Bashing path. Okay. Because there were a couple of other interesting things that happened that I heard about this week that just like blew my mind.
You want to? Okay, yeah, go for it.
Sealed why Apple and the iPhone is going to have dominance. Did you guys hear the story? I think I heard about it on Twit about, and I missed the news reports, but apparently that Sprint was sending the GPS data back to Palm from Palm Pre devices.
I heard about that, yeah.
Palm just kind of went, oh yeah, but we won't do anything evil with it.
Yeah.
So don't worry.
It's just all going into John Rubinstein's computer.
So there's that, and then apparently also some engineer working on the Android project tweeted out and said basically that 1.5 version 1.5, the Cupcake release, is the last release that you'll see on the G1s. Because they're just kind of maxing it out with that update,
oh.
and that's it.
Yeah, there's a little bit of forethought that didn't happen there, if that's the case.
So the G1 has the previous generation iPhone hardware. Well, not exactly, but Android. Very close to.
Oh, iPhone. It's comparable to the iPhone hardware.
The previous generation iPhone hardware, right? And that's another thing about the Pre. I just want to add in that the interface on the Pre is much slower feeling, much more sluggish than the iPhone, the current generation iPhone, I felt.
Yeah, I found the Pre interface to feel slow, but the overall appearance of it, the eye candy aspect.
Oh yeah, that's
just
nice.
Totally blew Android out of the water, I think.
Well, Google's not really known for shiny things.
No, they're the great beta company in the sky.
Yeah. So anything else you want to add, Adam?
No, it's just, I mean, you see those two things and you're like, what are these guys? What are these guys doing? You got one basically collecting data. Like, what possible reason could Palm need that GPS data for?
Well, just to see where everybody is so they can, you know.
So they can wave at him when they drive past.
You know, it's sort of like I did have to point out, as I was talking to people about this, you know, I opted in to let Apple know my information because I use the Find My iPhone feature with my .Mac account. So they can absolutely, they have my data, but I opted into that. And I'm pretty sure no one on Palm Pre opted for that. But, you know, and so they don't come out and say, we're not going to do it anymore. It's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we're doing it. We weren't going to tell anybody. But now that you know. Yeah, don't worry. We won't. We'll only use it for good. And
we promise.
Wink, wink. It's interesting,
you know. And then the Android thing. Yeah, just like. So I guess this tweet was the developer basically said he can't promise that there'll be any updates past 1.5. So, you know, that's kind of hearsay, but, you know, that kind of news gets out there and you'd think that would be something that Google would want to respond to pretty quickly, unless their plan is just, nope, everybody move to the G2. Because I know some people who have the G1 and almost all of them complain that it is just slow. I mean, slowness seems to be the most common problem. And I was like, you know, I've asked a couple of people, has it gotten better since 1.5? And they're like, no, not really. And it's just weird because usually when we get a new iPhone OS update, even on my first gen iPhone, when I upgraded to 3.0, things seem to get a little snappier and a little bit nicer.
Mm-hmm. I will say with the beta build 3.1, it's slower. But
you're also running a beta build.
I'm running a beta build and it feels like, just, you know, as an aside, I feel like Apple's doing a lot more with this version because they feel like they have a lot of time to just monkey around with it. I feel like they're kind of waiting for whenever AT&T gets their crap together and says, okay, fine, MMS, go.
Yeah. I don't know if Apple does this, but it's very common with betas and things like that for you when you're coding to have a lot of debugging stuff turned on, like extra stuff that normally wouldn't be running in a final release. So I don't know.
I'm assuming Apple's doing the same thing. It would make sense.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me when you hear that beta builds are a little bit slower.
But you can copy stuff from your contacts. Can you do that with 3.01? Did they add that? Or did they just kind of fix that security thing?
Yeah. That's a 3.1 feature.
I am permanently stuck on 3.1, unfortunately. So I can't get to the tethering anymore. Anyway, so
does 3.1 fix this email bug that we were going to talk about?
Do we want to talk about the email bug? Good transition.
I just want to talk about the email bug. So I think I received a link to the video from one of my listeners or the report of this. I forget who originally posted this video, but I think you mentioned, Michael, it was kind of a rehash of something that we already knew about. And I sort of was having the deja vu, so I didn't really move forward with reporting on it. And then all of a sudden, like, every Mac iPhone blog
everybody
was, like, reporting the story. Like, it was, like, the hugest security issue, you know, on the iPhone ever. And essentially, my understanding of it is that when you delete messages, email messages on your iPhone, they somehow don't really delete, or they're just sort of marked as deleted but not really expunged from the device. So when you go in and do a Spotlight search, those emails show back up on a Spotlight search.
Yeah.
And so, but I really don't understand. Is that exactly what's happening?
That is
it. Because I couldn't figure it out from any of these reports.
Did you watch the video?
No, I didn't get a chance
that
to.
That is exactly what happens. You delete the email, delete it from trash, Spotlight still finds it, and you can open it up and check it out.
And why is this being, I guess I see the potential security issues, but I mean, an iPhone seems such, for me, as a personal device. Yeah, I mean, I use it. Yeah. I have a lock code on it. It's my thing. I have the new .Mac features with the remote wipe, although we can talk about, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the security report about how the encryption on the iPhone, features on the iPhone are just, you know, really poorly implemented. That to me is like a way bigger story that got no coverage. And this thing's getting like a ton of coverage. And it's like, oh, I can go back in and find emails I deleted, 6 months ago. It's kind of like, I just find myself going, you know, so what? Yeah, that's annoying and frustrating. But I just don't see, you know, unless you have snoopy people around you that are grabbing your iPhone and searching for your old emails every 5 minutes, I guess I don't see the problem. I mean, maybe people are worried if I got subpoenaed and, they confiscated my iPhone, the police could find all my old emails. But then what are you doing at that point that you're worried about that?
You know, okay, keep in mind that for the past few weeks, I've been on drugs a lot, but it's okay. From the doctor, I'm not out picking them up off the corner. So I've missed a few things along the way. So does the email bug relate to POP accounts only?
Yes.
That was one theory. That was the another area I'm not clear about, because somebody said that.
I heard that somebody said that. Yeah.
Because if they're saying this is an IMAP problem, that makes no sense to me, because all your mail's on the server.
Yeah, I think it is related to more to POP. That's what I've been hearing, but I don't. Right, I can't confirm 100% unless Michael knows that it was exclusive to POP.
I heard that it was. Hang on, let me.
That would stand to reason, but I just wanted to double check. Which would account for why I can't duplicate the problem, because I'm using IMAP for all of my email accounts.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, just this is a good conversation to have on email in general. On the iPhone, I have found that you really want POP. Or IMAP, excuse me.
Okay.
On the iPhone, you really want IMAP.
Oh, yeah.
If you can possibly have the option for it. And I was really happy because I had GoDaddy, and I think they just got one of my accounts. I was just able to convert over to IMAP that hadn't been IMAP for the longest time because it wasn't offered. And I am so much better off now with my iPhone and getting mail. The iPhone just seems much happier with an IMAP email than a POP email.
Well, it's a pain in the ass trying to manage email with POP when you're trying to go between your computer and your iPhone. And it just gets too confusing anyhow. So if you can go IMAP, it just makes sense.
Yeah, I think I'm down to just my Cox email, which I can't do IMAP on.
Oh, ouch.
But I don't use that for anything.
What year is this again? And Cox still can't handle IMAP?
Let's not totally blame them yet, because I probably haven't checked in a while. But
oh, no, let's go ahead and blame them. I mean, I'm okay with that.
I mean, I'm not a Cox fan or anything like that, but I don't want to jump the gun and be like, because I'll get a million emails. Cox has had IMAP for 12 months.
So I have, I tried it just now. I've got only IMAP accounts, and it's not happening for me.
Okay. So it's probably just a POP issue. But, you know, again, I don't want to downplay these things, but I just find that, you know, that story is getting all this coverage. And then there was this other story from coming out of Black Hat from the security researchers that's just like, oh, yeah, here's how to, you know, crack the iPhone encryption in about 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And now, get to everything on the device.
To crack that encryption, don't you need to have access to the computer the data is stored on?
You mean the iPhone itself?
Are we talking about the encryption where you can, because the iPhone, iTunes backs up your iPhone?
No. There's built, one of the big new features, this is the iPhone 3GS.
Well, you can encrypt.
Oh, okay.
Your backups. So
hardware encryption
this
on the device.
This is why you should do drugs, kids, because you miss out on key parts like that.
Yeah, sorry. I don't know if I said iPhone 3GS. I probably made it sound like it was part of the iPhone 3.0 software. It's specifically in the iPhone 3GS, one of the big features, and I think this was kind of targeted at you know, getting more people to adopt it in the enterprise is that there is built in by default hardware encryption on the device for your data. And actually, I had heard because of that, the remote wipe works quicker.
I've noticed.
Because basically, it doesn't have to erase all your data. It just relies on the encryption and kind of, you know, messes. I don't know if it messes up the keys or what, but basically makes the data inaccessible because it's supposedly already encrypted on the device. But this guy, security researcher, came out and said, no, basically, here's, and he showed a demo of it. You can find the specific steps if you're interested, probably online. But, you know, he was able to get at the data fairly quickly with, you know, not a lot of effort.
Well, so, that's uncool.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're probably working on that in 3.1 or whatever.
Yeah, but still, I mean, if Apple's been advertising the encryption feature,
I never heard about
it's really strong and useful.
Have you heard about it though? That feature, this is the first time hearing about that feature.
I think it was something that was in the keynote.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I don't remember. Let's move on though. Should we?
You do need access to the device, though, just by the way.
Yeah.
But because I think it involves doing an image and using some of the jailbreak tools and things like that. But, you know, basically
you can crack
the image file and then put it back on the phone and you have access to all the data, something like that.
Well, that makes sense.
Okay. So it comes back to the same old thing with security. If you physically lose control over the device yourself, then all bets are off. Your data most likely will be compromised.
It'd be nice,
but I mean that's the number one concern, right? When you're in enterprises, you're going to deploy iPhones with all your corporate secrets to your people, and they're going to lose them.
Right.
That's why you have the remote wipe, and you lock your phone.
Yeah, well, that's why I need to look into more how the remote wipe works in conjunction with iPhone encryption, because I had heard people who did the remote wipe tests on a 3G or a first gen, and they said, "Oh, it takes forever."
Right.
To do the wipe, and that it was faster on the 3GS, supposedly because of some of this hardware encryption that's
built
into.
You'd have to recover that partition. You'd have to recover that information, which has already started to be overwritten with OS again. Who knows?
I'm just wondering, Dave, if it works the same way on the 3GS as it does on the 3G.
I don't remember.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm not willing to wipe my phone right now, though. So 3GS. Oh,
wait, what's your .Mac password, Michael? And I'll take care of it for you right now.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
I sent it to you in the Skype window.
Sweet.
Yeah, okay. So the 3GS is reportedly capable of HD video playback. Big deal, yes, no? I guess it would only make sense for playing it on your
3-inch screen? No, I mean, is this for,
TV.
Like, if you were, you video at it?
Yeah. It's not by default. You have to have a special app, but it's reported that it's fairly watchable.
Wasn't that reported with the 3G or something like that too? I mean, that's
I feel like it was.
That sounds really familiar.
Yeah,
and you know,
there were people, you know, doing all those video out tests and things like that, and I seem to remember it's like the hardware is perfectly capable. But you know, also define capable versus watchable. Yeah.
People have much lower standards than I do.
You know, what would make that a cool thing for me is if you really could do the 1080p out and Apple made some little connector that either went into your Apple TV or you could plug right into an HDMI plug on a television and it powers the iPhone. Then at that point, you could take your iPhone traveling, hook into it into the HD TV in your hotel room, and watch the movie that you just downloaded in HD. But since you can only download SD videos anyhow when you're on the road, you know, directly to your iPhone, what does HD output really get you?
Plus, it's a hack, and HD video takes up tons of space, and you don't have that much on your iPhone.
Yeah, so I don't know. The idea of being able to do HD out is kind of cool, but I'm questioning the practicality.
Yeah.
Yeah. This comes back to my classic argument that I always have with people about, you know, HD video on iTunes versus Blu-ray versus all these things. It's sort of like And there's what I call, you know, I don't know, it's the 90% rule or the 80, I guess it's the 80-20 rule most people refer to. It's like 80% of the time, standard definition is going to be fine for most of the things that I care to do or want to do. And, you know, that other 20% of the time, there's other solutions for that. And it just doesn't seem like, you know, I would rather watch HD on a Blu-ray player or drive it through my Mac than drive it through my iPhone. It's like one of those nice to have great. It'd be great if it was doable. But yeah, I'm with you guys on the practicality thing. You know, the file size, putting those things, just dealing with them becomes infinitely more complicated on a device like the iPhone. So it's sort of like, why bother with that 20% edge case?
Right. So let's move on to the FCC thing. Want to talk about FCC and the fact that Apple published the answers to their questions?
Ooh, the answers.
The answers, yeah. So, let's see. I pointed out some...
And they didn't blame AT&T.
They didn't. Yeah, they said that...
No,
they
didn't.
Here. Yeah, AT&T essentially was not consulted whatsoever with regards to the Google Voice apps. They also say that Google Voice, the application was not rejected, but Apple just said no. So that there's some kind of semantic difference.
Yeah. Well, okay. So what Apple is saying in their response to the FCC is that they have not rejected the application, that they're still reviewing it, and they have some questions about how the application functions that Google has not yet answered.
Yeah, it appears to alter the iPhone's distinctive user experience by replacing the iPhone's core mobile telephone functionality and Apple user interface with its own interface for telephone calls, text messaging, and voicemail. Duh.
This is the classic, it duplicates our features.
Well, I feel like that's the biggest load of BS.
No, so do I, but this is the argument they've used.
Right.
It's nice to see that they're using the same argument with a big developer like Google that they are with the little guy.
Yeah.
You know, at least we have that. At least they're not playing favorites when it comes to,
yeah,
like, we're
going to
reject you because you have a dialer that looks just like our dialer. You know, built in your app. And our customers are so not smart that they're going to be completely confused that, oh, wait, I thought I was dialing my regular phone, but I dialed on Google Voice. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, because these people who are so smart that have Google Voice applications, you know, they have Google Voice set up, would not get the difference.
I'm going to play devil's advocate just for a second, simply because it's fun.
Yeah.
All right, so if you have Google Voice doing all of the things that it does, the voicemail, the phone calls, the SMS, and you have that same functionality built into the iPhone. If you create, or if you have Google Voice as an application on the iPhone, you can, in essence, rebrand the device as a Google Voice phone instead of an iPhone. So from that argument, that makes sense, saying, look, you know, we're not comfortable with the Google Voice thing. From the standpoint, though, and here I'm jumping back to the other side of the fence, from the standpoint of we're doing application duplication features, I really have a hard time with that part.
Yeah, it's, I mean, of course you're using Google's service for the voicemail because you've got this, you know, got this little routing setup going.
Right. I mean, it's like visual, but see, I mean, again, to Jeff's point about being devil's advocate, absolutely, you could put your Google Voice app where you have the iPhone icon down in your favorite, you know, your phone icon down in the favorite,
sure,
or your dialer. So you replace that. That replaces your contacts basically with all your Google contacts, I'm assuming. I haven't seen how the Google app works, but I'm assuming it, you know, taps into that. You're, in essence, replacing your AT&T Visual voicemail, you know, voicemail app in there with Google voicemail. So absolutely, yeah, you suddenly have a Google Voice phone and not an Apple AT&T phone.
Right. But it's not a matter of doing VoIP or anything like that. You're still
you still have to use, in this case, AT&T's phone system for your calls to come in and to go out of your phone.
They're just routed through the Google Voice stuff.
Right.
But, and it, well, they do claim that it disables Apple's Visual Voicemail. And replaces iPhone's text messaging feature.
Yeah, your SMS is replaced too. Yeah, I mean, I understand why they might have a problem with it. I just, you know, why they might not like it, but.
Yeah, you know, it would be nice if Apple were to say, okay, here you go. Here, just, it's all going over the same network and use whatever app you want. But I also get the whole thing about, you know, we branded this device. We created the iPhone experience. We don't want this device to be the Google Voice experience instead and just throw the iPhone experience out the window. If you want Google Voice, go buy yourself an Android phone that has.
But it's just and so, you know, back on that other side of the fence, that's such a thin argument
it's lame.
You know, it's like I'm going to have both, and I'm going to use both. That's the reality, and they're used in my world for separate things, and I think most worlds for separate things. One's going to take that scenario and say, you know what, I'm going to make this thing a Google Voice phone, and I'm only going to use Google Voice SMS, and I'm only going to use Google Voice for, you know, there may be a small percentage, but the vast majority of people aren't going to be using it that way.
Absolutely.
And that's where we call BS on what Apple's doing, or at least I do.
You know, the idea of people becoming confused about where their data is coming in from, you know, AT&T through iPhone apps versus Google Voice. At this point in the game, I see that as a little bit of a stretch because Google Voice is still a new thing. So who are the people that are getting Google Voice numbers? People like us that are going to be out on the leading edge of the technology, rushing in where angels fear to tread. The average user is not going to be doing that. But down the road, you know, that of course will change because as Google Voice becomes more popular, then you'll have the average guy using it. I could see the argument holding more weight at that point because then you have the people that don't even have the ability to tell you what application they're using when just to check their email.
Yeah.
I stumped you, didn't I?
I'm going to pretend like I was listening. So I totally agree with whatever you just said.
Michael, you entertain me and I appreciate that. Thank you.
No problem. So Adam, did you want to pick up from that or is there something I should move on to?
Let's move on to some of the other questions.
Okay, yeah. Question 3, does AT&T have any role in approval of iPhone applications generally? So, you know, it says that Apple alone makes the final decisions to approve or not approve iPhone applications, but there is a provision in Apple's agreement with AT&T that obligates Apple to not include functionality in any Apple phones that enable a customer to use AT&T cellular network for VoIP, basically, summarizing. There are also rules in AT&T's terms of service that, you know, for example, you know, prohibit AT&T customers from using the network for, you know, stuff like Slingbox, you know, doing
it. Redirecting a TV signal. Now, that's apparently different, right, than streaming video, though.
Right.
I noticed that in here, that they're careful to, you know, word that in a way. It's redirect a TV signal. Because a lot of people have argued, well, why can I do Ustream and these other things? And I think that's the little loophole that Apple allows those apps to roll through.
So do we want to talk about Quick again? Has there been any official word on...
Why Quick?
Is this...
That's a whole... Yeah, I have no idea
the
on
only
there. Because
thing...
again, yeah, this does not disallow, seem to disallow Apple's, you know, reason for rejecting Quick. Although, do we know for sure that Quick even submitted a version of the app with the streaming?
The only
stuff
reason
built in
I can
to
think,
Apple,
because you can, you're essentially you're streaming, you know, video to Quick server at some point with the UnQuick app that they have. So I mean, what's the difference between right now and later?
No. All I'm asking is, do we know for sure from anybody at Quick that Quick actually tried to submit a version of the app that Apple rejected that had the streaming turned on?
I have not spoken to anybody at Quick, but I'm guessing they have not.
Yeah, I'm guess I that's what I'm thinking is I think they haven't even tried. And if I were them, I would read this and go, hey, we should probably see if we can get something through, especially since things like Ustream and some other apps are out there that are doing streaming video.
Well, I'm guessing now, they probably haven't submitted that version for using private APIs more so than anything else.
And see, that was the other thing I was going to get at with this. Coming back to this, you mentioned, you know, their main thing was that they have not rejected this app, that they're still reviewing it. And we know, I think you had told me that the Google app was apparently using some private APIs, the one that was approved originally on the iPhone, right?
For the
whole voice thing before we had voice commands.
Right. The proximity sensor it was using.
Yeah. The Google app. And I was wondering as I was reading through this and it was mentioning it, I mean, do you think Apple thinks that maybe this app might be using some of those private APIs as well? And that, you know, that's a no-no just in general for Apple's development thing. And since Apple and Google aren't as buddy-buddy anymore as they were back then, maybe Apple's, you know, calling foul on that as well.
Right.
Again, pure speculation, but I was reading through this and you were mentioning it, that was in the back of my mind. It's like, oh, I wonder if, you know, Apple's kind of seen that they're doing some more API, Google API tricks
in
iPhone apps and they're going, hey, you know, guys, you can't do this.
In these questions, I haven't seen any mention of that. And, you know, developers don't submit their source code to be reviewed. It's just the binary. So it'd be much, it'd be much harder for Apple to figure out whether or not they're using private APIs, although not much harder because I know Erica Sadoun, you know, has been able to pull apart. I mean, that's how we figured out that the Google app was using the private API. You know, she pulled that stuff apart and figured it out. So Apple can figure that out.
And you'd think Apple's engineers would know, like, there's certain functionality that's probably not doable with the public APIs that if they opened up an app and it's like, hey, it's doing this. Wait a minute, how does it do that?
Well, you think that'd be a much easier argument than, you know, they're replacing the experience instead of saying they're using this thing that they're not allowed to.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if the application, like in this case Google Voice, doesn't use private APIs, and of course I don't have a clue whether or not it does, but let's just say for sake of argument, it doesn't use private APIs. At that point, Apple wouldn't be able to use that as a tool to reject the application. So then they'd have to go to something else. Oh, we're duplicating functionality, or AT&T, they tied our hands, or something like that.
Okay. Now, question four is, please explain any differences between the Google Voice application and voice, VoIP apps. And it just says, Apple doesn't know if there is a VoIP element in the Google Voice application. And they're still looking at it, I guess.
Somebody should just call them and let them know.
Yeah, that would be the easy thing.
At Google. Google should just call up and be like, hey, no, it's not.
Because we all know it's not, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we're all assuming, but it wouldn't make as much sense as just doing it the traditional way that the Google Voice does stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Now, the way Google Voice works, to my understanding, is that when you get a phone call, it routes out through the regular cell phone service and shows up on your phone as a regular phone call. And when you want to do the dial back, it does a reverse dial from your phone back through AT&T's network and then out to whoever.
Yep.
Right. Connects the call. Well, that's how the service works. Like if you go to the web app today, right, you can set that up. You can do a callback, right?
Yes.
I haven't done it in a while. But I think to Michael's point, we don't know specifically because we haven't seen that the app that was submitted, you know, maybe they did do some VoIP thing in there for some strange reason why they would do that. And when they don't need to, who knows, makes no sense. But seems
but
weird.
We weren't in the coding.
We don't know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay, so question five is, what other applications have been rejected for use on the iPhone and what reasons? That seems like there could be a lot of answers to that. Is there a list of prohibited applications or of categories of applications that is provided to potential vendors, developers? If so, is this posted anywhere or disclosed to consumers? And Apple's response or summarized. Most rejections are based on the application, containing quality issues or software bugs, while other rejections involve protecting consumer privacy, safeguarding children from inappropriate content, and avoiding applications that degrade the core experience of the iPhone. Applications that are fixed and resubmitted are generally approved. And then they gave a list of representative applications that have been rejected originally and then submitted later on and been approved. They also talk about, applications may be rejected if they contain content or materials of any kind, text, graphics, images, photographs, sounds that in Apple's reasonable judgment may be found objectionable. For example, materials, blah, 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 obscene, pornographic, defamatory, etc. We have links in the show notes. There's a lot here.
I'm assuming also they mentioned, that if there's copyright issues.
Yep, copyright issues.
Right.
Obviously malicious software, backdoors, Trojan horses, stuff that messes up the phone. That kind of stuff makes sense. And it says, we also provide a reference library that can be accessed by members of the developer program that lists harmful or helpful information, such as best practices and how to get started, that kind of stuff. So, and question six is, what are the standards for considering apps? And Apple provides guidelines to developers in our developer agreement, as well as on its website, regarding prohibited categories of applications. There are more than 40 full-time trained reviewers, and at least two different reviewers study each application so that the review process is applied uniformly. Apple also established an App Store Executive Review Board that determines procedures and sets policies for the review process, as well as reviews applications that are escalated to the board because they raise new or complex issues. The board meets weekly and is comprised of senior management with responsibilities for the App Store. 95% of applications are approved within 14 days of being submitted.
Do they specifically mention Vinny? I just want to know if you got any credit. You got any?
He wasn't.
Any,
he wasn't mentioned.
Any ink in this report?
No, Vinny wasn't in there.
Dang!
But it does say that they receive.
Never gets any credit.
They receive about 8,500 new applications and updates each week, and roughly 20% of them are not approved as originally submitted. In little more than a year, we have reviewed more than 200,000 applications and updates.
I bet Vinny and his team drinks a lot. Oh.
Mostly while they're reviewing the apps.
I would.
Yeah. I mean, we see about 200 or so updates and new apps a day.
Wow.
It's pretty incredible, but it's interesting getting a little bit of a look behind what their process is. So, we see that there have, more than 40 full-time reviewers, and every app gets at least two sets of eyeballs, and they also have a review board.
So why is it still so screwed up?
Maybe Vinny has issues.
No, I think that I to your point, I'm joking. I mean, that really does put it in perspective. It's just the sheer girth of what Apple is dealing with on this app level, and they are going through a learning process, and I think it's getting better. You talk to developers, and I think generally they're positive about the App Store, but we know there's still issues out there that have to be worked through.
Yeah.
So, but this it's kind of cool to see the insight and know, okay, now we know,
a little bit more, at least.
A little bit more about what is happening behind the scenes in terms of at least the app approval process.
Right. And what Apple says they're doing, I'm certain that's exactly what they're doing. Because at this point in the game, okay, you have the FCC
right,
looking down their throat. You don't lie at this point in the game. So that they have to be shooting straight. If not, it's the most incredibly stupid thing they could ever do, and that's SciStar's job, not Apple's job, to be stupid in court.
Is there anything else we want to say about
Just approve Google Voice and approve quick, and I'll be happy and I'll stop complaining completely. So if Apple wants me to stop talking about it, that's all they have to do.
Yeah.
Okay. So
not much.
I would very much. Yeah. Both of those. Yeah. But I'm using quick, so just, you know, be jealous, of course. So
of course,
AT&T is working on their 850 megahertz network build up. Do we even want to talk about that, or do you just want to move on to picks?
We mention it real quickly. Okay. This was just something I saw up on iLounge as we were kind of going through stuff for the show, because it was a little bit slow. And I know one of the big complaints has been that specifically you hear a lot from the podcasters and people in San Francisco that AT&T's coverage has kind of gotten, I don't know if it's gotten sucky or it's always been sucky. I didn't particularly notice when I was there for Macworld that it was all that bad. And, you know, when there's a huge concentration of iPhones in a given area when you're at Macworld. But you do hear about it quite often. And I guess this is supposed to help with coverage in densely populated areas. According to the iLounge report, it's going to roll out in Atlanta. And I guess TechCrunch has some other evidence that indicates that it may also be underway in San Francisco. So those people in San Francisco might be finally getting a reprieve. So I guess just that this spectrum range covers densely populated areas a little bit better.
Doesn't it go through walls in that better?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the idea. Yeah, I think it's a lower... No, this is the classic, you know, so like this is the reason why for the longest time I kept my 900 megahertz, you know, landline wireless phone, because the 2.4 gigahertz, you know, a lot more susceptible to interference. So I guess, you know, it relates to, I don't know anything about the science behind this, but I think the lower the megahertz range, it does travel better, is less susceptible to interference.
Yeah.
Someone, I'm sure, can write us and tell us the science behind that.
Or tell us how we're wrong.
Or tell us how we're wrong. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm totally talking out of my butt, as I usually do.
Podcast at iPhoneAlley.com if you want to leave any comments, of course.
But yeah, this says they're adding more than 540 cell sites to increase capacity and coverage. So I don't know if there's a lot to report here. I think, and I mentioned this in the pre-show, that I think AT&T is suffering hugely from the massive popularity of the iPhone, and I think they really just don't know what to do. You know, I think it's why we don't have MMS. It's why we don't have tethering. They're just like, I'm sure the network engineers are just freaking out because we're using all this data, we're using all this voice, and they just had a huge influx of customers. I mean, massive influx of new customers, and I think their network just wasn't... I think they didn't even predict. I think they probably had projections and went, we think we're going to get this, and it just went way beyond their expectations.
I'm checking out another store, and it looks like users are seeing improved AT&T 3G network performance in New York and San Francisco.
Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. So things might be getting better. That was the only thing on that story, is if you're in one of those areas and you've been suffering, and I have to say, even here in San Diego, I've been noticing over the last 6-8 months a lot more dropped calls, problems with my voice that I didn't have kind of before the, you know, it seemed to get almost worse after the 3GS came out. But I think a lot of people just hopped on the 3G network.
You probably have people living in that area who know how to use an iPhone. Where I live, it's gotten better. But they've actually been, to AT&T's credit, they've definitely been improving a lot on the network here. So that's good.
Less bars in more places.
Mm-hmm. So there we go. And let's move on to our iPhone picks then. Adam?
iPhone picks. So I'm going to pull mine out. And if you were a child of the 80s, you will recognize this. It's another one of these silly apps, but I was very... Oh, here it goes. I came into it late, but...
Industry 2000's microprocessor, KITT for easy reference, a kit if you prefer.
So it is iKit, and it is a iPhone app that basically simulates Kit from the Knight Rider TV show in the 80s on your iPhone. And so it has the little voice synthesizer thing, so you can put this, you know, up on your dash in your car if you have a cool mount or something like that. And it's really hokey. It just has original sounds from the show. hokey until you realize that the other thing it can do is when you rotate it horizontally, you get the speedometer interface, and also, let's see, it does latitude. It also does compass, probably only on the 3GS. I haven't checked into it, but and it will lock into your GPS signal and give you the speedometer, an actual speedometer readout as you're rolling around. And you can double tap the speedometer to have it zoom up and be full screen. I know they're working on some new features. It's, you know, only 99 cents, and it's fun little nostalgia if you're, you know, another one of my little 80s nostalgia thing. I've been finding a lot of apps like Space Ace and those things that are taking me back to my childhood that I'm kind of enjoying right now. So it's iKit.
99 cents.
Yeah. And speaking of, I was kind of laughing because I was thinking about my pick as we were talking about Apple's, you know, what they reject. I don't know if there's some sort of licensing deal that's been made for the audio and the images and things like that. I'm guessing not. So hopefully the app is still on the store by the time you hear this.
Mm-hmm. So, Jeff.
So, I already changed my mind about what my app was going to be for today, but I didn't move very far from my original choice. Discovery. Okay. So Discovery Channel has an application out that lets you watch clips from the different Discovery Channel shows, lets you see behind the scenes stuff, and it's actually a really, really cool little application. And it's free. So you can go and take a look at stuff from MythBusters, and what are some of the other Discovery Channel shows?
Man versus Wild.
Yeah, there we go. Man versus Wild.
Shark Week.
Deadly yeah. Last
Catch. I'm just reading the thing. I don't know. That.
There you go.
It's only clips, though, right?
Yeah, it's clips, but it also does link back to the iTunes Store. So if there's an episode of a show you want to watch, it'll drop you back into the iTunes app and take you right to it. At the iTunes Store.
Nice.
So, yeah, so it's a pretty cool little app.
I have not checked it out. I will.
Well, though. Now you will.
I will, yeah. Okay, so my pick is an application. I can't believe I haven't talked about this application yet, but from Adam's researchers, it doesn't look like I've talked about this. So Wikipanion, is just a Wikipedia browsing application. There's a free version, which does a fantastic job at just providing a nice little interface for searching through Wikipedia, and has a nice little history, and it just, you know, works very well. I'm using Wikipanion Plus, which the big feature is enabling a queue, and that means that if you're reading a bit, you know, We've all been there. Anybody who reads a lot of Wikipedia, you start to read on a, you know, an abstract subject, and well, there's, you know, oh, there's that something that's linked, and I don't know what that is. I got to add that, you know, I got to go check that out so I can understand that part of, you know, whatever I'm reading about. And it just kind of builds up, you know, a lot of different things that you end up reading about. So this allows you to throw that stuff into a queue and go through it. Check it out. You can even save stuff in your queue. You can save it locally to the phone, so you don't have to necessarily be connected to the internet. It's got a fantastic history feature to it. You can also, you know, with the contents of any Wikipedia page, that's actually a little shortcut button. So that's removed from the actual document, but you can just see a little outline and click it and just jump right down to that page. And of course, my favorite feature of both Wikipanion and Wikipanion Plus is the ability to search within the page. So that is awesome. It's a little slow to search through a page, but you know, it's cool. Landscape, portrait mode. You can open it in Safari if you want. You can bookmark the stuff. Check out the related items. Let me see what else is here. You can make the font bigger.
It also does a nice job of reformatting the page, right? So it's
yeah,
not
it does.
Just like straight, you know, view of what you see in Wikipedia. I noticed because like the sidebar stuff, a lot of times they have those nice, you know, sort of summary charts and tables and lists and things like that. That all gets kind of reformatted in a really nice way. I have the app too. It's a great app.
The Wiktionary also included in the free version?
I don't believe it is, no.
Yeah, so you can hit the little gear and say, look up in Wiktionary.
Oh, yeah, no, it is.
Yeah, so you can even get to Wiktionary, too.
Never even used that feature before. That's awesome.
Boom. So the free version or the pay version, depending on how you use Wikipedia, it's a fantastic application. I had used Wikipanion free for a very long time and then, you know, upgraded to the Wikipanion, the $5 version. It's great app. Anybody who enjoys Wikipedia should have this application. Although, didn't Wikipedia just...
They just came out with their own application.
Which I have not checked out. It's free.
It's pretty slick.
It's free. Most people are giving it 1 stars.
Oh, well, apparently I must have a lower standard than they do.
Mm-hmm.
There's this dilemma. I think we talked about it on the show too, though, that I've noticed that because Apple changed that sort of, you can only review this app if you actually have installed the app and then sort of uninstalled the app or, you know, taken it off or actually own it. I guess you can still review it if you own it, right? But you actually have to have the app, right? So I've noticed inevitably that free apps always have, on average, lower overall lower rating than paid apps. You guys noticed that on the App Store?
Yeah.
If you haven't, you'll notice it. You'll notice it now because, yeah, absolutely. So it's much easier for someone to just like flame an app that's free.
Yeah, but this one has a lot more 5 stars. It skews. Yeah,
Wikipanion is awesome.
Yeah,
no doubt.
It has way more features just by the look of the screenshots.
Right. And the fact that Wikipanion's been around for a while now, so it's had time to overcome the...
Right.
Yeah, well, and the crappy reviews that people put up in the beginning, or, you know, just people that are pissed off and want to knock down an app.
Fine, get both, check them out, and realize at some point that Wikipanion's better. There you go.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. And with that, I will say that iPhoneAlley.com, you can get more news, tips, and reviews every day at that particular URL. And of course, you can share tips, iPhone tips, cool, find something cool on your iPhone. You want to share it with the world, let us know. And you can also request that we review a product or an application by clicking the Contact Us button on the side of the page. And you can get the list of iPhone picks, everything we talk about on the show, including the picks, at iPhoneAlley.com/podcast. You can send your feedback to podcast@iPhoneAlley.com. And Jeff Gamet can be found at the Mac Observer, MacObserver.com, iPod Observer, iPodObserver.com, and of course, Twitter.com/JGamet. Thanks for being here, Jeff.
Hey, sure thing. And as always, it's a blast.
Thank you. It's great having you. And of course, Adam Christensen's at the MacCast, MacCast.com and Twitter.com/MacCast. Thanks for being here, Adam.
Hey, thanks. Great hanging out with you guys again.
As always. And my Twitter is Twitter.com/MichaelJohnston. And that's not where you're going to get anything about the iPhone. If you want something, you know, banter from me, then that's fine. If you want iPhone stuff, go to iPhone Alley or twitter.com/iPhone Alley. That's where you get the iPhone stuff. So, and with that, another iPhone Alley podcast is in the can.
An iPod. That doesn't involve another application or, you know, it's like, here's a cool feature I found on the iPhone.
Like top 5 porn sites that have iPhone formatted pages.
There you go. And I tell you, actually, if you wrote that tip, you'd probably get an ass load of traffic.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I just can't bring myself to do that.
Maybe ass load was the wrong word choice. Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't pick up on that either. That was good.
I didn't pick up on it until after I said it.
Yeah. Frankly, I'm surprised that girls still talk to me.
Girls are weird. You never know.
Yuck. No. Yuck. Yuck. No. You have to get them and put them away and you lose them. Yuck, 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 yuck. No. Yuck. No. Yuck, yuck, no. Yuck, 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 yuck. No. Yuck. No. Yuck, yuck, no. No. You have to get them and put them away and you lose them. Nobody wants a stylus. So let's not use a stylus. Nobody wants a stylus. So let's not use a stylus. We're going to use the best pointing device in the world. We're going to use a pointing
made on a Mac, motherfucker.